time for the best coverage of the top stories in sports. The Sports Wrap with Jason Page starts now.
Yes, it does on a Thursday. Thank you, Chad Erickson. Great to have you all with us. A lot to do over the next 60 minutes. Kind of a fun show today, I'm proud to say. We'll be joined by Eric Pincus. Actually, not going to lie to you. We were joined by him last night after the game. Got some post-game reaction and thoughts with him after the Celtics put themselves on the brink of another world championship with a stirring performance, a wild finish as the Celtics beat the Mavericks in Dallas 106-99. So we will obviously get into that here. David Ardsma slated to join us as well. Talk some Major League Baseball with him. Stupid people doing stupid things and playing stupid games. You win stupid prizes. We'll get to that. Plus, one very furry character may have thrown a better first pitch than Stephen A. Smith. But did he throw a better first pitch than me? We will answer that question. But we start things out in the NBA with the finals. And last night we had some fun doing our first Sports Wrap live. With myself, Sam Yarnell, Robert Littal from Black Sports Online joined us, as did Eric Pincus, who will you'll hear his thoughts on the game and the win for the Celtics last night. Boy, everybody's talking about Luka Doncic today, including one Brian Windhorst who went off on him. We'll get to that in a second. But Sam, Celtics build a big lead. We watch the Mavericks come back and rally and get to within a couple of points, but Boston with the answers late, even without Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah, Jason, it was the Celtics asserting their dominance in this game. And we'll get to the Luka thing in just a minute, because I think there is a large storyline there that played a huge role in this game. But at the end of the day, the Celtics flexed their muscles in this game. You mentioned it. We saw those Mavericks get out to an early lead. And I said on the live show with you, if I was a Mavs fan at that very point, I would not have been comfortable, because we saw the exact same thing in game two. Obviously not so much in game one, where the Celtics were up, 17 points at the end of the first quarter. But game two was a one-point game. Actually, I believe the Mavericks led that game by 1 point at the end of the first quarter. And we kind of saw the same thing out of the gate in game three with the Mavericks. They came out, they looked good. They looked like they could, you know, take a lead, but they just didn't have that ability to step on the throats of the Celtics, and they let them come back and come back and come back one more time. And eventually here we are with the Celtics up 3-0, one win away from, you know, getting the duck boats ready for that championship parade.
You know, look, there's a lot of criticism being thrown the way of Luka Doncic after game three. And what I gotta be honest, I think some of it's unfair in that I think there is an overreaction to what happened with him in game three and the four quick fouls and the two late fouls that follow him out of the game, the sixth, by the way. I mean, if you're the official in that spot, you got to swallow the whistle. There's no way. It's either a no call or you call it a charge. You have to understand the situation in that spot. Conversely, I think Doncic has to understand the situation too and understand how valuable he is to that team, and he has to be on the floor in that spot. All of that having been said, I felt like it was more, I would be crushing Kyrie for not showing up in the first two games in Boston the way he did, far more than I would be. And I think there's been more of an overreaction to that than there has been the correct reaction to how bad Kyrie was and left his star out on an island for the first two games of the series. Brian Windhorst went like over the top after the game last night, saying, yo, Luka's got to never get to the next level, blaming him. He's a hole on defense, all of this stuff. First of all, this is who Luka Doncic has always been. He's never been a great defensive player. So I don't know. I don't know why anybody is extremely shocked at the fact that all of a sudden, you could take advantage of him or you could take the ball at him. So Windhorst, it just felt like, it almost felt personal the way Windhorst went after it last night for about a minute and a half with Scott Van Pelt on SportsCenter. It almost felt like it was personal. To see how he reacted to it.
Well, Jason, the fact of the matter to me is this. Luka Doncic right now is getting blown by in these finals 66.7% of the time. That is the highest blow-by percentage in finals history. He is playing Trey Young level defense, right? And yes, he's not a bad defender or not a great defender. You're right. He never has been. He's a guy who scores a bazillion points and does everything on offense. But he's not Trey Young. Like, he's not. He needs to at least do something defensively. And when you don't do anything defensively the way that he's done in this series, and then on top of it, you complain to the refs as much as he does, mm-hmm. you're not going to get the benefit of what he's looking for. So I feel like the reality to me is that Luka Doncic is playing his regular season style of basketball in the postseason. He's not living up to the moment necessarily with his, not necessarily with his play, but with his emotions. He's acting on the court like he's, you know, playing the 65th game of the season rather than playing in the finals. And I think it's really been detrimental to him on the defensive side of the ball.
But let me ask a simple question. And it's what all this boils down to, and all the bloviating from Brian Windhorst can't obfuscate this fact. Does it matter? Are they winning this series if he doesn't fall out last night? Are they even close to being on the Celtics level? I was having this conversation with Eric Pincus last night, and I don't think it's in the clip that we're gonna play in the next segment, but they're not even the Mavericks now that we've seen three games of this series and watched the Celtics. They're not even the second best team in the NBA. I mean, they're going to be the runner up, you know, by virtue of the fact they're going to lose, you know, in the NBA finals. They're not even the second best team in the league. They might not even be the third or fourth best team in the league. They came through the gauntlet that's the West, and, you know, things went the right way for them and the matchups and, you know, Minnesota, you know, being what they are and sort of learning how to win. It all worked out and that's great, but they're not even the second or third best team right now in the NBA. So whether Doncic goes out there and doesn't fall out last night and plays a little better defense, Boston's winning this series in five or six anyway. I mean, so to me, you know, to go crazy about Luka Doncic after this game doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I don't know if they're not the, you know, I just can't get behind them being the third or fourth best team.
I could.
Who are you putting above them right now?
I'll put Denver. I'll still put Denver ahead of them.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's close. It's definitely close.
I'll still put Denver ahead of them. Yeah, I would still put Denver ahead of them for sure.
Okay.
We're coming back. Eric Pincus will join us. We'll get into some of the NBA stuff with him from our post game last night. Don't go anywhere. Sports Wrap continues on this Thursday. We had a lot of fun last night. Our first ever Sports Wrap Live. We did it exclusively on X. A lot of people came over and checked it out. We'll do another one of them soon enough. Game 3 of the NBA Finals goes to the Boston Celtics. A lot of discussion around Luka Doncic. We touched on that in the last segment with Sam. But got to talk about now, with the writing sort of on the wall here for this Mavericks team, what it's all going to mean going forward. Now, before we get to that point, we obviously do have a Game 4 coming up on Friday night, which we talked about with Eric Pincus from Bleacher Report, the sports business classroom. He's the GM there as well. Got some thoughts with him. The NBA columnist joined us on the Sports Wrap Live show. You're looking to your crystal ball here. Is this ending four?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it's 3-0. Like, there's a point where you're like, there's just like, I was at Lakers or whatever. They got one from Denver. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, they're going to win three more in a row. And it was like, no, the next game they got blown out. So it's probably over in four. If Dallas has this, like, gutty comeback where they get the win, it's going to be over in five. I'd say probably over in four, at best five. I don't see us going to six. I'm not, you know, we're always wrong every once in a while, and it's not like I'm making some big crazy leap. I don't think Dallas – they haven't shown enough here other than just like a couple of nice little runs. They had a couple of good runs in this game. They had a good run to start the game. They had a good run that brought that 20-point game down. But like I said, Boston really didn't choke it away because, yeah, they lost their lead, but they got their composure back, and they closed it out. And that's not choking. I didn't feel choke yet, and I feel vindicated on that. Yeah. Now, we would be talking differently if they did really choke it out.
Oh, yeah. Let me ask you one last one, and then we'll wrap this up. Let's assume, obviously, Boston closes this out, whether it's in four, whether it's in five. Boston closes this out. Does this feel more like something where we could have a sustained period, two titles in 4 years, three and five, three and four? Or does it feel to you more like the way Denver wound up, where it's one and because the dearth of talent around the league? And now, granted, they're not in the West, so the path to the NBA championship or an NBA or to an Eastern Conference final is a little easier, I think, than it is in the West, where there's just so much talent and five or six teams could conceivably come out of the West. Or do you feel like there's an opportunity here for this group, this core group, to go on a sustained run?
There's no one that they're losing this year, right? Like there's Tillman maybe is a free agent, like Cornette. Like there's no one in their top seven that are leaving, right? Like Jalen, Jason, Drew, Porzingis, White, Horford, Pritchard, they're all under contract. They still have Hauser under contract too for cheap. So why would they fall down? Now, this is a team that's been to the finals a bunch, never got over the hump for a lot of different reasons. They're over the hump, but they're not like some newbie who lucked into a ring. They have a very real chance of doing it. Like Philadelphia, I don't know who's the third player outside of like Maxey and Embiid next year. And Indiana's fun, but like I don't know that they're a real contender. New York, your Knicks, at least we can debate it and argue it. There's some potential there. I don't know. Bucks, I don't trust Dame. I think Drew's better in some areas that help you win more. I love Dame, and he's a better scorer, always will always be a better scorer than Drew Holiday. But at the highest level, I don't know. And then who else? Like Orlando? There's always Miami because Miami's Miami. They're always a puncher's chance to get in here and wreck nerds. I'm sorry. It's just like you can't like throw them out because they go to the finals every other year, it just seems like. But who else? I mean, there's no one else in the East that I look at that maybe you're Knicks. And then in the West, yeah, there's real talent out there. Denver. I don't know what the Lakers are going to do. The Clippers, Dallas will try to find a way to get better. The Suns are at least in the conversation. Not a big fan of who they are. The Thunder were the best team in the league. The Wolves. But there's no reason to say Boston should fall back. Like at least when Denver won, we were like, yeah, they're probably not going to be able to keep Bruce Brown. And Jeff Green's probably not going to stick around either. And even though Jeff is older, it's like, yeah, their depth is going to get a little weak. They have no means to replace it. Dallas, like they have the expiring contract of Tim Hardaway Jr. I could see them looking to move him and to try to find one or two more pieces that help them. But like Luka's back, Kyrie's back, PJ's back, Gafford's back. They can move Josh Green if they want. If they Maxey Kleber, they could probably move if they need to. Lively's back. Powell's movable. The only player that is the issue for them is Derek Jones Jr. That's the guy that it may get difficult to keep. And that doesn't mean they can't keep him. It just means like they're going to have to be creative to figure out how, because they don't have his rights. And these exceptions that we used to take for granted that all teams had, they don't have at their payroll level, at the same level as somebody else. But I think it's reasonable that they can keep Derek Jones Jr. However, that's the money that you would spend on someone else.
Right.
You assume, like, if you want to get better, you might have to spend that on Derek Jones Jr. Now you're the same team, unless you're finding something back that moves the needle already. You're a championship team minus one, right? You got to the finals. You didn't win it. Maybe move a Josh Green, Maxey, PJ. They have some players to move. They have a little bit of pick, but not. They don't have a ton of draft picks. 25, I think, is available. I'd have to double check that off the top of my head. I think their first and next year's draft is available. So one first, couple of expirings, maybe Josh Green has some value for a team who wants a young guy, still youngish, not drastically overpaid, 12, 13 million. That's the path I'd start to take. And Hardaway, you know, you put those two together. There are some issues about aprons and things like that we won't get into, but there's some, if you're a Mavs fan, nothing I say right now is going to matter anyway, because you're probably, yeah. You know, drinking your beer and sobbing. Yeah. So I apologize.
That's all right. Always appreciate it. Eric Pincus, Sports Business Classroom. Check him out there. He's a GM. Also, Bleacher Report does a terrific job on the NBA. This was fun. At least we had a competitive fourth quarter to talk about.
This is why I took the fourth. I'm a vet. I've been around men a long time. You got to know. Like, first quarter, whatever. Like, you know, there's going to be one of the two teams is going to go on a run, and the other team's going to come back by the end of the first. I could have told you that yesterday, yeah. Right? So, and second and third, whatever, subs and stuff. And no, you got to get the fourth.
More Sports Wrap after this. The one and only Sports Wrap continues on this Thursday. Thanks again to Eric Pincus for being part of our live broadcast on X on Wednesday night. First time we have done that. Basically from start to finish of the NBA Game 3. We might do some tweaks to it and do it again. I don't know, maybe we'll do it for Game 4. Just something we're trying out. Different way to interact, different time of the day to interact and kind of have a more genuine, authentic reaction rather than the reactions and sometimes overreactions that come with games a day or two later. It was kind of interesting to be watching it in real time and living it with fans in real time. It was kind of fun. We'll get to do that tonight as we watch this Edmonton Oilers team try to rebound Sam Yarnell as they take on the Panthers Game 3 Stanley Cup Final in Edmonton, and that place will be up for grabs after fans had to watch them go into Florida and lose the first two games of that series. And as much as, Sam, they lost the first two games of that series, it felt like they lost their composure as well. And that's something they're going to have to get back, especially against as disciplined a team as this Florida Panthers team is.
Yeah, Jason, this series has been so frustrating for the Edmonton Oilers. I mean, look at Game 1, the shot differential. Edmonton puts up, you know, whatever, 30-something shots and gets shut out. And then obviously in Game 2, only getting the one goal and then not getting a ton of shots on net. To me, Edmonton seems a little lost. I say that because obviously coming off of the last series where they kind of established themselves as this hockey team that looks for the best opportunities, only take shots in the best opportunities and keep those shots numbers low in a per game average sense. And then you move into the Stanley Cup final and they're taking, you know, near 40 shots in the first game. It's tough for me to justify that for the Edmonton Oilers and then trying to go back to it in game two and scoring first and then letting in four unanswered. They seem completely lost to me. That said, I think we're going to get a lot more offense in this game. We've got, you know, goalie Bob off of his home ice. Obviously, Stuart Skinner has not looked great. 7 goals through 2 games. I think that this one opens up in this game tonight. I don't think that Bobrovsky will have the best performance, if you will. I would be more inclined for someone to have a hat trick in this game for than one of the goalies to have a shutout.
You like the over?
I don't know.
Sounds like you like the over at 5.5.
That is exactly what I was alluding to, and you can get it at pretty good juice right now. I would go over 5.5 in this one. We've got to get at least one over in this Stanley Cup final, right?
I'm sure ABC's hoping for it, although the ratings in game one were really good. I didn't see the numbers for game two. 5.5 is the total, -104 on that if you want the over, -118 if you are looking at the under in that game. And Bobrovsky right now is the favorite to win the Conn Smythe at -190. It almost feels to me, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. But maybe I shouldn't say this because maybe I'm just off base about it. But it feels to me like Conn Smythe is like Super Bowl MVP, and a goalie's always going to have a better chance to win it than say another player because they play so prominently in the course of a game. The same way a quarterback many times is going to have a better chance to win NFL Super Bowl Most Valuable Player. Am I wrong? I don't know. I'd have to look back historically at the Conn Smythe, but it feels to me like a lot of times the goalie's going to have the best chance playing so prominently in a game.
I think it's generally the star of the team, right? You were looking at this before when we were coming in, and it was McDavid at the top for the Conn Smythe, even though his team wasn't favored in the series. It's generally the best player on the team. Just going back in my head, 2018, Ovechkin wins it for the Capitals. I can't remember who won it last year, but I think did MacKinnon win it when the Avs won?
I think so.
Regardless, I understand what you're saying, but I definitely think that when you're looking at the odds for the Conn Smythe right now, Bobrovsky the favorite. Right, but Stuart Skinner nowhere near the top. Stuart Skinner all the way down at 200-1. Mm-hmm. And that's not anywhere near reminiscent of the number that they would give the Oilers to come back in this series.
Can I do you one better? Not only is Stuart Skinner 200-1, but on FanDuel, he's such an underdog to win Conn Smythe. They don't even have a picture of him. They don't have a picture of him or Sergei Bobrovsky now that I'm looking at it. What the hell's going on, FanDuel? Sorry.
Yeah, or Calvin Pickard, which is interesting that they're hanging a number for the Conn Smythe Award for the Oilers' backup goalie, for him to come in and lead this team to victory in the series. Mm. But no, see, like McDavid is the favorite in terms of all Oilers now. Bouchard second, Dreisaitl third. So it does tend to be these guys who are the stars in the faces of the team, who are really the team leaders. And that's exactly what you're seeing here. Now, if the series ends today, obviously Sergei Bobrovsky wins it. That's no question. At -190, the books say that he probably will win it in this series. But am I going to touch that number right now? No. As a matter of fact, I would go with another Florida Panther just because if Bobrovsky has two more games where they both win, but he also lets in three goals in each, they're going to start looking to guys who score multiple goals and that kind of thing. So I would stay away from Bobrovsky to win Conn Smythe right now. I don't have a particular bet in mind to give you, Jason, but I can't lay that 190 on a goalie to win the Conn Smythe after only two games of the Stanley Cup final.
Right now to win the series, it's Edmonton +365, Florida -490. So if you've got a hunch, I don't know. Is that a good number? Is that a fair number? 365? Does it feel a little low?
It does. It feels pretty low to me. I would also say, just looking at these numbers over on FanDuel right now, Jason, I would bet on the series spread. You can get Edmonton +1.5, +172. I think this series has to go 6 or 7 games. And if it does, you're automatically cashing with Edmonton there.
Good point. And again, tonight, Florida +115, Edmonton -138, and that total once again at 5.5. David Ardsma will join us coming up in a couple minutes. We'll get some thoughts with him on Major League Baseball. Yankees continue to roll, baby. Giancarlo Stanton hit another one to the moon. Get some thoughts with him on that. Sam will rejoin us for something to consider a little later on. Don't go anywhere. Keep it moving on this Thursday. Let's do some baseball. Bring in our friend David Ardsma. He's jacked up. Fired up.
Looks like he's fired up about baseball.
It looks like he's ready to go out and throw an inning.
I had my second throw today. Just showing some stuff. I hit 80. So I'm there. I mean, a little 80? Warm up, man. I got it.
Can you still get 90 if you wanted to?
Oh, yes. Yes, easy. 90's easy. It's like getting 92, 93. That's getting to almost average is the hard part.
Fair enough. I'd be lucky if I could get a ball to go. My whole right arm is shredded. I'd be lucky if I can get the ball to go 90 feet right now. All right, let's talk a little bit about look, it begins and ends with the Yankees to me right now playing the way they are. It's hard to find a flaw or a defect in this team, maybe first base because Rizzo's not hitting. So people are starting to look for solutions there. But, I mean, it's a healthy enough sample size. The Yankees are the real deal.
Yankees are absolutely real deal. If you're looking for an issue there, yes, you got to look at first base and say your big circle there and say this might be a hole. At the worst case scenario, though, they have somebody who knows how to play the position. They've got no issue at first base. It's that spot in the lineup, right? And Anthony Rizzo, for whatever it is, whatever he's providing you, I'm still not necessarily going to bet against him in big situations. He knows how to get, you know, in those big hits, big situations. He's at a point of his career where he doesn't need a home run or a double. He'll take a base hit. So it's not the worst place to be, but the big hole we do see is when they were missing Soto for that little bit, it was a completely different lineup. Yes, when he's healthy or when he's in that lineup, just in, even not healthy, it's a great lineup. But when he's out, it is a different lineup.
Aaron Judge right now. I mean, you saw Barry Bonds when Barry Bonds was Barry Bonds. This is the damn closest thing I could recall to that. What he's done here over the last 6 weeks is just astonishing.
What he's just done in the whole season, I mean, let alone these last 6 weeks, are absolutely insane, hitting over 400, just smashing the ball. The last 30 games alone, I mean, 16 home runs. You know, he had
four
home runs.
Let me ask you something. Take all that aside, because I only got seven minutes with you. Let me take all that aside. How would you pitch to him right now as a pitcher? Ooh. How do you pitch to him?
Next.
Come on.
Next. Put him on base.
You're a competitor, though. You're a competitor. You want to get him out. How are you getting him out?
There's two ways to look at it. As a manager, put him on base. As a competitor, I'm going up and in. I'm coming up and in as much as I can and just own that. Let him try to open up. What you have to do with A-Rod, right? Kind of treat him the same way when A-Rod is MVP guy. Up and in, try to get him to start turning that shoulder if you can, and then try to bury that slider down and away and hope he swings at it. At this point, you're crossing your fingers, you're giving it your best, and you're just hoping there's no one on base when you have to face him.
Because, I mean, right now he's, and now you're getting Stanton hitting home runs. I mean, he's only hitting 230, but Stanton's hit, you know, 900 feet worth of home runs here over the last couple of days in Kansas City. And boy, what a slap back to reality for Kansas City, who's playing pretty good baseball in that AL Central. And all of a sudden you realize we still got a ways to go.
Playing great baseball, playing incredible baseball. There is a big difference right now between the Yankees and their momentum and what it means to just constantly keep this train rolling and being hot. I don't think the Royals are going to be in a bad position, but I think it did come back to reality a little bit when you're 11-5, 10-1, you know, even though you're in that first one, 4-2, you see a big difference. But tonight's a difference maker. If they come back and win tonight, win today, hey man, it might be a different outlook on that series.
Talk about the Braves, because you know they're not playing well right now, and their general manager, when the general manager comes out and publicly says you're not playing well, what does that tell you? You're not playing well?
I like it when GMs say that. You need to hear that sometimes. You need a GM to basically say, hey, we know this is a problem. Something's got to happen. Acuna obviously being hurt doesn't help, but even when Acuna was in the lineup, it's not like they're playing great. They're only scoring 3.4 runs over the last 40 games. And even the last 10, it's been 2.3. So you're getting 2.3 runs. That is horrible. That is nothing. It doesn't matter what you're doing of a pitching staff. You're going to have four Cy Young winners on that staff. You're still not going to win baseball games. They need to hit. I mean, nobody in this lineup is really producing on a level that they should be. No one. Maybe Ozuna. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, and the Phillies are threatening to run away. Really, every division but the AL East right now doesn't seem you know, as competitive or as competitive as baseball would probably like, which means a lot of teams in the mix for wild card spots. Your man Paul Skeens, we just love watching him every time out there. And when you get fans in St. Louis who are smart baseball fans, when you get smart baseball fans for the road team that are giving you the kind of ovation, and those weren't Pirates jerseys they were wearing. No. Those were Cardinals fans standing up and applauding this guy. I mean, and the Pirates are in the mix right now for a wild card.
I've always said this, one, some of the best fans in baseball, but that they know what good baseball is. When Paul Seen goes out there, 6.1 innings, no walks, 8 punchies, no runs. Like, this kid is the real deal, and he's showing it in different places against different teams at different times. It's really impressive, and that's what I love about that fan base. I love that they're able to just sit there and go, we recognize something real, and they saw it.
Do you get a sense, we talked about this last time I had you on, If they're in the mix, there's going to be a temptation to let him keep pitching. I mean, he threw over 100 pitches in his last outing, so they're clearly stretching him out. I mean, if you're in the mix, is the fan base going to go ballistic if you don't keep putting him out there?
That's why they can't just shut him down. Him and Jones, they can't just shut them down. You have to find a way to limit innings without limiting their appearances. Get them in the games, limit their maybe their innings, maybe the amount, like, right? They throw 100 pitches, fine. Let them do it right now. But when you're in August, you're gonna start cutting that back, where you're going to add a 6-man in that rotation.
And it's kind of like the Luis Hill problem the Yankees are going to have, because he's going to go way over his max innings that he's ever thrown. David Artsma, former big league reliever, hanging out with us on the show. Always appreciate it, my man.
Absolutely.
We're coming back. Let's have a little fun on this Thursday. Lord knows we all take ourselves too seriously. So let's have a little fun with something to consider. Something to consider, Sam Yarnell. Play stupid games, win stupid prizes. The Cincinnati Reds version. What'd they say? This kid was 19 years old. This 19-year-old Ohio State student. I wonder if the school will take action against him. If you don't know what I'm talking about, here's the video of this 19-year-old. He looked a lot older than 19. Who did a backflip on the field at a Reds game and then was promptly tased for doing so. Sam, were you ever tempted to run on the field during a game? Any of your friends ever try to dare you to do something like that when you were in college?
No. No. Don't. I will say, yes, I agree with you. Didn't look 19. Don't know what they're feeding him out there in Ohio, but man, it's working. I don't know how you can pull a taser on a 19-year-old running on a baseball field.
I absolutely do. Man, you start doing backflips, and I mean, hey, that's one way end it. He ain't gonna run around for long with that thing in his back.
I think that honestly, Jason, this was my main takeaway. The officer was so jealous of the kid's athleticism that he had no other choice. When he saw the backflip, he was like, "Welp, I can't do that, so I've only got one option here." It was quite the interesting video there.
I like it, man. Let's tase people. Shoot them in the leg. I'll be like Donald Trump. Can we just shoot them in the leg? Shoot them in the leg? Can we do that? Isn't that what Trump said about the protesters in D.C.? Can't we just shoot them in the leg? I like that one. Let's do that, too. Good luck. And by the way, he's pled not guilty. We all just watched you run onto a field and do a backflip. How are you pleading not guilty? I mean, like, I'm just saying, I don't understand it. All right, who did it better? Grimace threw out the first pitch at the Mets game last night, apparently. And look at the costume that Grimace is wearing. I mean, it's Grimace. That was a hell of a first pitch. I saw this last night. I said, I got to talk about this on the show today. How do you throw a first pitch as good as Grimace did? Grimace is a male, right? With that costume on, to get that thing even close to home plate, I was very impressed. Now, compare that Grimace first pitch in New York at Citi Field to another famous luminary, if you will. Talk about taking yourself too seriously.
I was going to say another large round guy, but...
No, I'm not next.
Oh.
We're going to go Stephen A. Smith next, throwing a first pitch at large, a Yankee game.
Still round.
throwing a first pitch at a Yankee game, and this was Stephen A's first pitch. And it left me wonder, oh my God, he threw a 55-footer. It barely made it into the dirt area. Yeah, I would look down at the ground too. Stephen A. Smith or Grimace? Who you got?
Oh, it's not close. Grimace by a zillion. But I will still say, as impressive as Grimace's was, and a little peek behind the curtain back in the green room before the show, Jason and I just having a little early morning conversation with our coffee, and we were talking about how we were both impressed by the agility of that shoulder on Grimace to get out of the costume and still get above the ball. Truly impressive. I will say, though, not the most impressive first pitch we've seen at Citi Field, Jason. No, that belongs to 50 Cent.
Oh, have I ever? I don't know if I've ever told that story on this show. I know I've told it a million times. I was at Pacquiao Mayweather in Vegas. 2015, whatever it was. I'm at Pacquiao Mayweather doing, because they had a radio row set up for that. For 2 days, and I did shows from there leading up to the fight. And there, all the celebrities and athletes are coming around the room. And 50 Cent's agent comes over, publicist comes over and goes, hey, you want to interview 50 Cent? I'm like, yeah, sure. It was right around the time that boxing movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and him came out, I think. And 50 Cent is coming over, and his publicist goes, real quick, right before he gets to me, the publicist goes, by the way, don't ask him about the first pitch. Like, that was the only topic that was off limits, which is the only thing I'd want to talk to him about. He had just had, like, the first pitch, and I'm like, that's the only thing I want to talk to him about. But we were nice. We didn't ask him about it. Plus, I didn't want Curtis 50 Cent Jackson to jack me up. So we saw Stephen A. Smith's first pitch. We saw Grimace. This is my first pitch from 2015. Bridgeport Bluefish, rest in peace, Bluefish. My first pitch at a Bridgeport Bluefish game for Gay Pride Month. Matter of fact, it was 9 years ago, almost to the day, that I got to throw out the first pitch for that game. And there you go. It was a little wide, but not bad, right? We're not. I think of the three, mine was the best. That goes without saying. What? What's the problem here? You think Grimace or Stephen A. Smith's first pitch was better than mine?
Definitely not Stephen A. Definitely not Stephen A.
Mine was on a line. It was a little outside, but it was a legit pitch. I was a pitcher when I played baseball.
Gimme Grimace. Money line.
Wow. That hurts. It may not hurt as much as what I'm about to do in the next segment. You'll have to watch to find out. All right, just about time to put the wraps on this baby for a Thursday. Once again, a reminder, if you miss anything from the show, it's all available for you in the podcast. Sports Wrap with Jason Page podcast, available Monday through Friday and on the weekends. If you want to catch up, go and check it out. Available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, you name it. We are on all of them. Let the absurdity begin. It's time for odds and ends. Odds and ends, Sam Yarnell. It is an American institution. It is gluttony unlike any other. It is the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. And it's where Joey Chestnut and Takeru Kobayashi have made themselves legends around the world by being able to woof down as many hot dogs as they possibly can in, just 3 minutes, something like that. Well,
I think it's 10.
Is it 10? Is it that many?
It's 10.
All right, maybe it's 10. But Joey Chestnut years and years ago overcame Takeru Kobayashi, who then was banned from the contest because he didn't want to sign a contract with Major League Eating. So he kind of faded into relative obscurity, even though he still competed in other eating competitions and exhibitions and things like that. Then he recently announced he was retiring. But then the story gets more interesting because Joey Chestnut, who is the GOAT when it comes to the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest, and frankly, any type of eating contest, I think he has the world record for Big Macs. He's got a whole bunch of different ones. And Joey Chestnut recently signed a deal with Impossible Foods. Check out some Impossible Foods bratwursts right here. This is not a paid endorsement, by the way. I bought these for, I think, $9.99 for like four of them. So Joey Chestnut recently announced he had done an endorsement deal with Impossible Foods for their hot dogs. And I think it was 4 years, $1.2 million, or 3 years, $1.2 million. I think 4 years for $1.2 million. Then there was some sort of dispute about whether Nathan's banned him from taking part in the 4th of July hot dog eating contest or whether he pulled out of competing in the Nathan's hot dog eating contest. There seems to be some dispute as to what's going on with that. We'll wait and see what happens. Netflix, never one to run away from doing anything they can to bring people to their platform, has jumped into the live sports game. So, hey, why not? They announced on Wednesday that we would be getting Kobayashi versus Joey Chestnut in a hot dog eating contest, one-on-one, mano-a-mano, which was news to a lot of people considering that Kobayashi had decided to retire because of the strains and the wear and tear of eating hot dogs. I think he's about the same age as me now. Well, it appears he's going to come out of retirement, and there on September 2nd, it'll be Kobayashi versus Joey Chestnut. So where does that lead us? Well, I wanted to, in honor of Joey Chestnut and Kobayashi going at it, and in honor of Joey Chestnut doing a deal with Impossible Foods for their hot dogs, I went out last night. They didn't have the hot dogs available at my grocery store, but I bought an Impossible Bratwurst, and I decided, here on the air, right here on Sports Wrap, I am going to try for the first time, not doctored, it has nothing on it. This is an Impossible Bratwurst. And I'm going to try this on the air, and I'll give you my legitimate reaction to what this thing tastes like, because I've never tried it. It's plant-based meat, apparently. So I'm going to give this a shot, and we'll see how it goes. All right, here we go. Moment of truth, Sam Yarnell. All right, there we go. Take a big bite.
I'll just give a play-by-play for the listeners on the podcast version of the show. Jason's given us about 8 good chews so far. I would say the facial expression is still good. We've got a decent facial expression after the first swallow. He ganders at it and goes in for another one. Another big bite for Paige here. The facial expression starting to dwindle a bit. We've got big chewing action going on. One more bite. Everybody knows the rules. This one a double bite. Paige going for the twofer here. The strong chewing motion as he's ready to give us his review. Let's hear it.
I got to tell you, it's much better than I would have anticipated. It's actually very good. It's very good. I would eat this.
Real bratwurst, yes. Like a meat-made bratwurst? Absolutely. Not that it's not.
But absolutely. Yeah, no, that's what it tastes like. It's meat from plants. I would eat this again.
It's good.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's Now that's interesting.
That is interesting. And I gotta say, that's good. Now I understand why Joey Chestnut did it. They wanted to offer me $1.2 million for 4 years. If they wanted to offer me $1.2, I'd probably do it. Hell, if they just wanted to give me free bratwurst, I'd probably do it. Sam, I know you're a little skeptical about the this sort of thing. Go and try this. This was actually quite good.
You have, you, Jason Page, you have sold me. Mm-hmm. You have sold me on those. I will go out and get me some Impossible Bratwurst.
Yep. Ooh, I almost choked. Thank you to David Arnsma, Eric Pincus, you, Sam Yarnell. NASCAR Friday, Tino Patino tomorrow. We'll see you then.